Welcome to Sisters Talk Crime. We are your hosts,
Diesel
and Crystal.
If you love hearing and learning about true crime, then this show is for you. This is our very first episode where we're going to talk about a case that hits home.
The Yogurt Shop Murders. These murders took place in Austin, Texas. The town's worst nightmare happened on December the 6th, 1991. It was just another day for Jennifer Harbison and Eliza Thomas, working at the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt Shop. Little did they know they were going to face the worst moments of their whole entire life. It all began when Eliza had showed up for her 7 o'clock shift, and then an hour later, her co-worker Jennifer had also showed up. It all felt normal during the day with regular customers and daily routine that one has to do when working at a frozen yogurt shop. Later that evening, the two youngest, Sarah Harbison and Amy Ayers, had showed up, either by foot or had been driven from the North Cross Mall to help the girls close so they can get out quicker. The girls had planned to have a sleepover at the Harbison house, and it's Friday. Everyone wants to have fun, so they were really eager to get out quickly. Since the two youngest were not employees and were very young, they had to hang out at the back of the store. They were still having a good time, hanging out, eating, and helping by washing dishes, cleaning, and much more. The only reason why Amy and Sarah were at the shop that Friday night was because of that sleepover. And if it wasn't because of that sleepover, they might have not gotten their lives taken away. We can blame it on so many other things, but at the end of the day, we're always going to have heartless monsters doing horrible things to good people. It's sad to think that we have these people in the world who are only wanting to cause tragedies. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. Okay, guys. Going back to the yogurt shop where Eliza and Jennifer were working in their early hours of their shift, they encountered many customers that day. After many people giving tips regarding who they saw that day, the day that these girls were murdered. And guys, we're talking about more than 300 tips from witnesses. Yasel and I had decided to include only the most important information in this case. So let's talk about them. First, I'm going to start with Eliza Thomas' mother, Marie Thomas, who came to the shop to bring food for the girl. And we don't know exactly who came outside with her, but we only found one source claiming that she was there. But we wanted to include her because that's Eliza's mom, and that was the last time she saw her daughter. After Marie left at 9:45 p.m., customers reported they had seen two undefined men. Many people believe that these two men went to the store to scope the place out. Around 10:15 to 10:25 p.m., the girls began to pre-close. They started mopping, wiping down tables, and many other things. At 10:42 p.m., a couple had came in to purchase some yogurt. One small, one large. They decided to sit inside the shop and enjoy their yogurt. The couple right away seen the two men sitting near to the register, but far away from the entrance door. The woman felt like the men were eavesdropping on the girls, and the woman was too. She felt uncomfortable, and the woman said that she had seen Jennifer cleaning the lobby of the store. And at 10:47 p.m., the couple had decided to leave. The store had a policy that about 10 minutes before 11 o'clock, they would lock the door so they wouldn't have any new customers. But the remaining customers inside can easily exit. And at 11:03 p.m., there was a no sale rang up, meaning that someone took money out from the register. Could it have been from the girls counting the money, or the two suspicious individuals asking for the money?
I At 11:47 p.m. that night, Austin Police Officer Troy Gay, patrolling North Austin, reports a fire at the I Can't Believe It's Yogurt Shop at 2949 W Anderson Lane. Firefighters soon arrived and put out the fire, not knowing they were... Soon after, Detective John Jones receives a call.
Jonesy?
Yeah?
You hear about the call 2900 West Anderson?
Yeah, I'm headed over there.
Okay.
I'll meet you out there. 2900. 2900. That's a business.
John.
Go ahead, Wayne.
It's apparently a robbery, homicide is three fatalities.
That's 10-4. Learn route.
At the scene, Lieutenant Rene Hector Garza and firefighter David DeVue crawled through the store with flashlights in hand. They first spotted a foot, then an arm, then a body. Eventually, four bodies, burned, naked, bound with their own clothes, their legs spread, all shot in the head execution style. When Detective Sergeant John Jones entered the flooded scene, the first thing he said was, "Holy shit." Two of the bodies were stacked on top of one another, whether by the force of the water or an act by the killers. We may never know the actual truth, but this is what investigators think happened. The girls were most likely forced into the back room of the shop. They were forced to strip down. Further, were tied and gagged with their own clothing. Both Ayers and Jennifer Harbinson were raped. Amy Ayers was the only victim whose body wasn't burned beyond recognition, and an ice cream scoop had been found between her legs. On December 9, 1991, the police report that more than one person was involved in the robbery homicide, and no forced entry was found. The girls thought to have been dead before the fire was set. Of course, with the shop being set on fire, a firefighter's first instinct is to put out the fire. Them not knowing the horrific crime scene inside, they washed away evidence. And of course, most evidence was already lost due to the fire. And I'm going to talk about the evidence the investigators had. So, police found testable DNA in Ayers, but the tests at the time were not enough to connect DNA to an individual. They also found DNA on the clothing used to tie up Eliza. It would be several years before researchers could connect the samples to DNA profiles. Detective John Jones and his men found a slug and a shell casing from a .380 caliber, but not much else. Later, four .22 bullets were taken from the girls' bodies. So this is what the cops knew. There was about $540 missing from the register, which what Crystal talked about earlier, that now this confirms it. The killers were the ones who took the money. There were two guns used, a .22 and a .380 pistol had been used in the crime. And obviously we have DNA evidence. And so now we're going to be moving on to the suspects. At one point, the investigators had about 342 suspects. We will not be going through all the suspects, but we will talk about the main suspects. So guys, we quickly wanted to mention one suspect. He's not a main suspect, but we wanted to quickly mention him. Because what he said was literally
it was really dark, what he said.
Like, scary, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And this person is a serial killer. He's a Satanist. He's an infamous murderer. And his name is Kenneth McDuff.
He flat out said, "Had I done it, I would tell you, because I'll be proud of it." Like, what?
Dude.
That's pretty bold. If you tell me, that's pretty bold. Who are you?
A murderer?
A Satanist?
A serial killer? Girl, no.
That's a big no-no.
So now that we got that out of the way, let's talk about the four main suspects.
Who are they? Well, let's find out. On December 14, 1991, police interview a 16-year-old Maurice Pierce, who had been hanging out that Friday night at the very same mall as Amy and Sarah, and was picked up for carrying a .22 caliber handgun and 16 bullets tucked in his pants. the same caliber as one of the two guns used in the crime. Pierce told police that 15-year-old Forrest Wellborn had borrowed his gun and had killed the girls. Wellborn claimed he didn't know a thing about the murders. He and Pierce, along with Michael Scott and Robert Springston, both 17, had taken a stolen car to San Antonio that night.
After that, literally, there was nothing else. Like, the case literally went cold. No information, no nothing, no arrests. Like, they were still getting tips, but, like, nothing was done. No justice was yet to be served.
And nearly 8 years after the crime. 8 years. Why did it take so long? I don't know. Do you?
Well, we don't know. Like police didn't say much to the community. They kept stuff to themselves because they were worried that stuff was going to get out and that the murderer could get away with this.
I know that a lot of police departments, they don't like to give too much information because it would discourage any new evidence, any good viable evidence to like support in court and stuff like that.
Yeah, they like to keep a lot of stuff to themselves, which I mean, I guess it's a good thing, but like I'm pretty sure they weren't like telling the family what was going on. And you know, when something like that happens, the family are in complete like trauma. Like they literally lost their kids.
I think I even once read on the articles that like one of the family even hired their own investigators because, you know, they were not getting answers. And like when you're a parent and your child dies, you want answers. You want somebody to be locked up because, you know, they cause harm to you.
Somebody to be responsible for their death.
And it was really hard also for like the cops, you know, getting all that heat from the media, from the parents, from the school.
Yeah, not to mention that was like Austin's biggest case. They had never seen something like this, and it must have been a little like they must have been a little lost. I mean, they are trained to do these type of things, but seeing it like for the first time, it was probably like traumatizing. But let's see, 8 years, what happens next, Crystal? 8 years, what do we get after 8 years?
Well, we get an arrest. On Wednesday, October the 6th, 1989, police in Texas and West Virginia arrested four suspects in connection with the murders. Robert Burns Springston Jr., 24, was arrested in Charleston, West Virginia. Michael James Scott, 25, of Buda, Texas, was arrested in the Austin area. Maurice Pierce, 24, was arrested in Louisville, north of Dallas. And Forrest Wellborn, 23, was picked up in Lockhart, Texas, southeast of Austin. The prosecution stated at one hearing that DNA in the case had been tested against more than 70 people, including these four men, and failed to match. Although there was no physical evidence tying to any of the four to the scene, Springton and Scott confessed to the crime after extensive questioning by police.
And now we're going to be playing those interrogations for you. So we're going to be playing Michael's first, and then we're going to be playing Robert's.
What happened next, Mike? That brought back the memories, didn't it?
I remember looking at the gun.
You ever seen that gun before?
I'm not positive.
Does that look like the gun you've seen before?
It looks like the gun I've seen before, but I'm not positive.
Is that the gun you shot somebody with, Mike?
I don't.
Is that the gun you walked up behind somebody with and shot in the head? Is that the one? Talk to me, Mike.
Yes,
you did that, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
We've just opened some more doors, haven't we, Mike?
Not really.
You sure?
Yes, sir.
The problem is, we got to get one of our options.
I cannot give you any more truth than I've already given. Where do we go from here?
Why can't you? Because you're going to dig yourself into that thing? Well, you're already there. You've already dug the hole. The hole's there.
Oh, then I'm in it. I don't know. That's what I keep telling you guys. I mean, my God, this was 7 years ago.
But this is one of the most significant things that ever happened in your
life. That's what I keep trying to explain to you. If I was there and I partook in this, I would remember these things.
And you do remember these things.
No, I don't. No, I do not.
You're the coldest guy I've ever talked to in my life. Are you a cold-blooded murderer?
No, sir, I'm not.
I think you are. I think Maurice is absolutely true about you.
Well, then
let's... You're the coldest guy I've ever talked to.
To take.
Pardon me?
Then let's take whatever actions we need to take. If that's what you believe and that's where you think this case needs to go, then let's go there.
We don't want to go there.
But I'm doing everything I can and have exceeded my limits of helping you guys. Where do we go now?
Alright guys, so we just added a couple seconds from the video. If you want to continue watching the whole video, then go ahead and go to our website. Scott was questioned for 12 hours on September 9, 1989. Questioned again the next day and questioned again on September 13, 1989, resulting in 20 hours of videotaped interrogation. Okay, now guys, we're going to be playing a little skit, and this is going to be Scott's confession. Something that we wanted to point out to show you guys that he was being coerced to a confession. So I'm going to be the police, and Crystal's going to be Scott. Well, what did you use to tie up the girls?
Venetian blind cords.
Not Venetian blind cords.
Napkins?
You can't tie somebody up with napkins. It went on and on until, through the process of elimination, he correctly guessed that the girls had been bound with their own clothing. Those confessions formed the foundation of the state's case against the two men. In June of 2000, after two grand juries refused to indict Wellborn, charges against him were dropped. 1 year later, Springton, who had confessed to raping Ayers, was convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death. In September of 2002, Scott was also convicted of capital murder but received life in prison. Meanwhile, Pierce sat in jail awaiting trial until January 2003. When charges against him were dropped, Springton's conviction was overturned due to violation of Scott's confession had been used against Springston, but Scott didn't testify in court and therefore couldn't be cross-examined by Springston's attorneys. The following year, Scott's conviction was overturned for the same reason. Springston's confession had been used against Scott, and Scott's attorney hadn't been allowed to cross-examine Springston. The DNA found in the body of one of the victims, who is Amy Ayers, did not belong to any of the original suspects, nor does it belong to any of the more than 100 men that the Travis County District Attorney's Office had gathered. Notably, there is no physical evidence linking either man to the scene. Although water and fire destroyed much of the crime scene, 6 fingerprints were found on the cash register drawer. 2 were linked to an employee, but 4 have never been matched to anyone. Not the girls, not the boys, or any known employee. Moreover, several hairs from more than one individual were recovered from the bodies, but none has ever been matched to anyone. On Wednesday, June 24th, 2009, Michael Scott and Robert Springston walked out of jail after spending nearly 10 years behind bars for murders that they didn't commit. And guess what? After that, the case went cold. And it's been nearly how many years, Crystal?
It's going to be 28 years on December the 6th.
Their death anniversary is coming up, and it's just really sad to think about that. Who knows if we'll ever know who killed them? And we will never know if justice will be served.
So, where are they now?
Well, Pierce died. He died on December of 2010. Almost 8 years after murder charges were dropped. He was pulled over for a traffic stop. He jumped out of his car and ran.
We have a little bit more details for you right now. Police say Pierce ran through a stop sign. He got out of his car. He started jumping over fences to get away through this neighborhood. When Wilson finally caught up with him, he grabbed the knife from the officer's belt, stabbed him in the neck right here in the street.
We also wanted to mention someone, and that's Eliza Thomas' mother, who died on March 2015, not knowing who took her daughter's life.
That must have been horrible for her to, like, you know, pass away and not know not having answers.
I also think, like, you know, like, you know, when your child dies, you want to see what happened. Like, who killed her? Who could have done this? And to not get answer and for her to die like that, I'm pretty sure she died pretty sad, not knowing.
Well, I mean, we all know she's up there with Eliza, and they're probably talking, and then, you know, I'm pretty sure she's happier now to see her up there, so. And if she was suffering, she's not suffering anymore, so at the same time, it's a good thing, it's a bad thing, but, I mean, if she was suffering, she's not suffering anymore.
Okay, guys, we're going to talk about our thoughts. And Yasel, do you think these boys did it?
I honestly don't think they did it due to the physical evidence that the investigators have. It did not match any of the boys. And they were literally wrongfully convicted. They were coerced into a confession. And it was just... No, I don't think they did it. No. What do you think?
At first, going in the investigation, I really thought that these boys had something to do with it. Because of the gun, it was the same caliber as the one used in the murder. And Maurice was picked up from the mall, and he had the bullets. And it, to me, it was convincing. But after, like, hearing the videos and the recording about the investigation and how he was questioned, I felt like it changed my mind. I don't think that they had something to do with it. You know, they were wrongfully convicted.
Agree.
Yeah. And Yasel, what do you think about those two men at the shop?
I think they did it, that they're guilty. And that's the reason they haven't came forward to say that they were the ones at the shop. They literally never came forward to say, I was there at the shop. I left at this certain time, and here is proof that it wasn't me. But they've never, have never come forward.
Okay.
What do you think?
I honestly think that these two men really, they had a lot to do with it, you know, because they never came forward, you know, like.
So you don't think they're the killers?
I do think they're the killer, you know. Yeah. I do 100%.
Do you think it was just them, or do you think it was, like, more people involved and not just two?
I think it had to be more than two people, because there was just so much going on. That I personally feel like it had to be more than two people.
I mean, you would think that the girls would try to, like... There was four girls, two boys. Like, I mean, yeah, I get it. They're strong. But they could have, like, grabbed something, a chair maybe, and hit one of them. Like, go survival mode. But if there's definitely more guys, it would have been scarier. It would have been easier for the guys to do stuff. So, my guess is also... There was probably another person involved. Yes. At least one more person.
Yes, for sure. I agree with that.
Okay, guys. And this is a wrap of our first episode. Tell us on our website what y'all think about this episode. This is our very first time doing it.
Yes, we would appreciate all good reviews.
Good feedback. No, but honestly, like, if we need to fix something, if y'all don't like something, like, let us know. Because we would want to fix that for y'all. And if y'all have any case suggestions, go to our website. We're going to go ahead and write it on the description of the podcast. And you can just go on our website and suggest cases to us that y'all would want to hear. And as well, you can go to our YouTube channel to look at videos and pictures of the case so y'all can get a better understanding and how the girls looked like and everything like that.
We want to stay connected with y'all, so head over to our website to chat with us and get to know us. We're going to leave the link on the description below.
Thank you for hearing Sisters Talk Crime podcast.
And a big shout out to Anchor for sponsoring this video. Bye, guys.